there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Shouldn't you be at home?
Batistuta! Oh, what a fantastic hit!
Back in towards Brecker! And that is an absolute gem of a goal.
George Weir on the prowl, bang!
Di Matteo to Signori! Fabulous strike! And here's an opportunity, Zola, lovely dummy! Oh, what a goal for Parma! And here's Victor!
Ravanelli again. Baggio.
This is Deschamps, and it's two.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Only Hatton.
No.
Hello and welcome back to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? I'm Chris Gold. Joining me, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello.
And these are special. Now, that's what I call Quickly Kevin episodes. And here, hoarding a load of Manchester United season reviews for the apocalypse, it's Michael Martin.
Hello.
What do you plan to do with all your season reviews?
That's actually true. I've got all those in.
Yeah. Do you even have a video player?
No, I've converted them all to QuickTime movies. One day I'm going to watch through them all because I think there's probably some great content.
I'm going to say it, Michael. If that's not in the next few weeks, you're never going to watch them.
Did you ever...
Bit busy.
Did you ever have one season review you always watched as a kid?
I'm sure we must have talked about this, but I had a tape called Liverpool Team of the Decade.
Right.
Which was about... Just followed Liverpool throughout the 80s. I think... I remember it started with like a... I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. You know when you get like...
Yeah,
it like started with goals from the 80s. Like, McDermott! That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Interspersed with emotional music. And then like a man on a ferry on the Mersey. Like footage of a man pulling into Liverpool on a ferry.
Oh, nice.
But what, I don't understand the analogy. What they're going
Well, no,
for
it was just like...
You're arriving
no,
in Liverpool.
No, it was more like just nice shots of the city and that kind of... Like, what a place. That kind of feeling. This really is a special place.
I had one which was you had to save up and get vouchers from Smith's Crisps and send off to get it. It was one of those kind of mail order things. And it was Brian Robson narrating classic moments from the World Cup. But he was so bad and so stilted. But it was the first instance when I had sort of seen like world football, like the sort of history of football. So that famous moment when the player runs out and kicks the ball away from the free kick during the World Cup. Yeah. And when the goalkeeper, like poleaxes him, the guy comes out.
Harold Schumacher.
Yeah, Schumacher. And I was just in awe. It was like this whole world being opened up to me. It was incredible.
I was obsessed with West Ham 92-93, which was we missed the inaugural season of the Premier League. We got promoted directly after. And there's a bit in it where Trevor Morley, our star striker, scores a goal. But in scoring, he heads it into like a melee of boots, gets booted in the face. And the commentator goes, Trevor Morley scored... And he kind of sits up and he goes, and what a goal. And, yeah, the blood's emerging now from his mouth. Similar to Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is in the cinemas this week.
Wow.
It stuck with me. It sticks with me my whole life.
Of course.
Even now I'm like, was there like some sort of thing here to promote Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Do you know we've never talked about this as well? Oh, sorry to keep the catchphrase. And I remember this from a World Cup 90 sticker album, but it had like the Orbis one.
The Orbis one, yeah.
So I think it was Brazil qualified. I might have got this slightly wrong, but the gist of it is in their final qualifier, they had to beat Chile. Yeah, so it would have been in 1989, but for the 1990 World Cup. Chile were losing, and then a flare got thrown out of the audience, out of the crowd, and hit the Chile goalie who went down.
Yeah.
He was called something like Roberto Ruiz or something, right? and he went down and he was covered in blood, and they abandoned the match. They tried to abandon the match or something.
Right.
And then he got found to have burst a, it was a plan, and he'd either burst a blood capsule or he'd cut himself or something. And the plan was, if they were losing, to get the game abandoned by someone throwing on a flare and hitting him, or he saw his chance or whatever. I can't remember.
That's insane.
What?
How is that not more famous?
That's who I remember this fight.
So do you think the person who threw the flare was in on it, or do you think he
I presume so, because you're not going to get that opportunity otherwise,
but,
really.
But who... Has he got a sort of NFL quarterback in the...
Who's Tequan Whittock?
You'd have to turn and face it and, like, manoeuvre yourself to hit the flare, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But I think if the play's up the other end and the flare goes onto the pitch... In the area.
Oh, so you think obviously in back then there weren't the volume of cameras.
No, I don't think you've seen. I don't think there's footage of the hit or anything.
Yeah,
but why didn't they sub him off?
Sure, rather than do I remember this right? I'm sure we could read the story. But. Yeah.
Do you know what? Just speaking of do I remember this right? I missed the jingles. I don't have to make any more jingles anymore.
Why is that? Because we've.
Well, I think we've either exhausted all of the topics, but
we just need to get more when we spot.
When we spot jingles,
now is the time to.
Yeah,
I've got the time to make new jingles.
Him. Well, that is a do I remember this right? So let's have the jingle for old time's sake.
Do I remember this right?
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 Do I remember this right? Right.
Right. Hi guys, listening to the most recent. Podcast. The question. This is a long time ago. The question of whatever happened to Peter Fear came up.
We need a jingle for whatever happened to Peter Fear.
Oh God! What have I done?
What's the soundtrack to Cape Fear?
Peter Fear, where are you? Peter. Where did you go?
I can help out on what happened to Peter Fear. He's been a contestant on Popmaster on the Ken Bruce show on Radio 2.
Oh, wow.
What? A couple of times in recent years. And when having his usual pre-quiz chat with Ken, confirmed he's now a London cabbie. From what I recall, his score on Popmaster wasn't particularly impressive. Keep up the good work, George.
Mm.
Well, if you've got any more insight into the life of Peter Fear, please contribute to our brand new item, Whatever Happened to Peter Fear?
Where goes the fear? Is that...
Here goes the fear.
Technically, that also qualifies for the Phil Thompson directory. So,
it does.
Let's have a little medley.
For the local answer, ask Phil Thompson.
Hi, guys. Regretfully, I've only just discovered your glorious podcast, and I've been binging on it for the last few weeks. I thought I'd bring to your attention my hometown team of Margate FC. In the mid to late 90s, Margate were briefly sponsored by the ska legend Bad Manners, whose singer, Buster Bloodvessel, owned a hotel in the town called Fatty Towers, which, if I remember this right, used to weigh guests at check-in and turn them away if they were too thin.
That can't be true.
You can see the shirt in use during Margate's 1997 FA Cup tie against Kevin Keegan's Fulham. For a nice bit of symmetry, Margate are now sponsored by, Chris?
The Libertines?
Correct.
Really?
Who are just about to open their own hotel come studio on Margate Seafront, but as far as I'm aware, there are no weight restrictions for the upcoming album rooms. Love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Callum Bottle.
Wow.
So there we go.
That's the blood vessel.
If you've got any more sponsors, this is how you get in touch.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list at quicklykevin.com.
Okay, it's time now for part four of our lockdown specials featuring some of our favourite guests from the last five series. First up, Mark Lawrenson discusses the enigma wrapped inside a riddle that is David Batty, and then his time as a coach under Kevin Keegan at Newcastle.
Welcome to Quickly Kevin, Mark Lawrenson.
Quickly Kevin, what's that?
That comes from Quickly Kevin, Will He Score, which is a piece of commentary.
Right.
Are you familiar with it?
No.
It's when David Batty stepped up to take his penalty in 1998.
And missed.
But just before, Brian Moore turned to Kevin Keegan and said, quickly, Kevin, will he score?
And he said, yeah.
Yeah. And we did this, and then we'd had Jim Rosenthal on the show, and he said, yeah, that actually tormented Brian Moore. But it's too late now. We've changed and chosen the title.
What a great commentator. Do you know David Batty, I think, apart from when he went back to Leeds as a guest with his kids, I think he's got twins, doesn't watch any football.
Yeah, well, we've heard.
Absolutely does not watch football. And I was at Newcastle on the defensive coach with Kevin as well, Terry Mack and that. And he always said, not interested.
Just didn't like it.
No. And he was the only one who was allowed to live X amount of miles away from Newcastle. Because Kevin just said he'll be absolutely fine. He was never, ever late for training, but he was first away.
David Batty comes up time and again on this podcast. People say he's a man of mystery, that he used to get paid cash when he was a footballer, that he's off the grid now.
He was great though. He was just such a really, really good lad, good trainer, good player. When I coached him, he was a better player than I realised.
Really?
Yeah, I just thought he was a bit of an assassin at first, but he was much better than that. Much better.
Was he quite emotionless? We heard that after France...
Emotionless?
90... Yeah.
Well, he's from Yorkshire. What do you expect?
France 98, when he missed the penalty, apparently the team got back to the dressing room. Batty had had a shower and had his suit on. Beckham was still in tears.
He probably said, what's all the fuss? Our bats wouldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
And when I was at Sky, I went to interview Keith Gillespie.
Yeah.
And obviously it was Kevin Keegan, Terry Mack. They were up there. And I did this interview, came back, put all the stuff together and did the Saturday programme. But before we went on air, I got this, oh, there's a phone call for you, Terry McDermott. I'm thinking, they don't like something that obviously we're going to do, and he wants to pull the Keith Gillespie interview. And I'm like, Terry Mack, expecting. And he went, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, nothing. Why? He said, oh, Kevin wants to speak to you. And I said, what about? He said, he just come up, he wants to speak to you. So I said, okay. He said, we'll fly you up, fly you back. And the tomorrow was Newcastle 5, Manchester United 0.
Oh, yeah, okay. When Philip Albert scored that chip.
But, yeah, and before the game, I go see Kevin. I sort of, semi knew him and everything. He said, fancy a job? Defensive coach. And I went, I'm not sure. And I said, I don't mean that rudely. Like, I've just started on, you know, this media gig, and I'm getting like a few jobs and everything. He went, you can still do some of that. I said, but you'll have to move up. I'll let you still do the games and all that kind of thing, obviously when Newcastle weren't playing. And so rang him the next day and I said, yeah, I'll take it.
And what did the job of defensive coach
involve? Nothing. I did absolutely nothing. Honestly, I did absolutely nothing. But my CV looks great because we finished second. We got in the Champions League. Looks great on my CV. But
second isn't the thing that people remember about that season.
No, it wasn't that season. It wasn't when they blew it.
The season after.
And by the way, they blamed Asprea, but nobody in the club blamed Asprea. It was nothing to do with him.
Really?
No, yeah, he was unlucky. They basically lost a lot of confidence and stopped playing.
Yeah.
But when they played and everyone bombed on, they were such a good side. So Kevin said to me, 3 months, just have a look, train with us and all that kind of warm up and do a bit of coaching, but nothing defensively.
You what?
For a defensive coach?
Nothing.
So what did you do?
I trained every day. I was the first pick of the staff when they had a five-a-side and everything. I got myself fit and all that. Anyway, so after about 3 months, I said to Kevin, look, I said, I'm earning money under false pretenses. He said, no, you're not. Absolutely not. He said, I'm more concerned about the movement going forward and everything. And I went, right. He says, but what do you think anyway? I said, well, you've got the same defensive players that you've had for a few years and we need some new ones and stuff like that. And he said, okay, I get that. And then the next thing is, they wanted to go public, didn't they? They had a share issue.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Kevin got the hump. Because this guy came in to kind of do the transition from a football club to a public limited company and all those kind of things and float themselves on the stock market. They offered him a new contract because it would look good for the shareholders.
Yeah.
Because he was like a messiah up there. And he kind of fell out with them. In the end, Kevin just went, I've gone. And Arthur Cox was still there. Arthur Cox was his like shoulder to cry on and all that. Cox was a like, real proper football man. And on the Monday morning after the news, Cox went, right, you can do your job that you're here to do. And that was the first session that I took.
Really?
Next up, referee Dermot Gallagher talks us through some of his more memorable moments on and off the pitch.
So we normally ask non-footballing guests a certain question or two. have you ever met a 90s footballer? I mean, that's redundant for you. Is there any 90s footballers that stick out for you?
Zinedine Zidane. Really? He's just the greatest player I've ever refereed.
Were you reffing on the pitch with him?
Three times.
Really?
You couldn't believe it. He played for Juventus in a game I reffed in the Champions League, and Del Piero got the ball and smashed it across the field, and I thought, good luck with that. And he just took it out the air on his foot and passed it to Antonio Conte, and I just went, wow.
How much can you appreciate the game when you're refereeing? Do you ever think, you know, a player gets the ball, do you ever think, go on, have a pop from there? Or are you too focused on refereeing?
The more relaxed a game is, in so much as the players are just playing, you don't have to get involved. You've got more time to watch the build-up, the talent and everything. But obviously, if you have a really feisty game, it's a lot more difficult.
Were you on the pitch for an amazing goal?
Loads of them.
Yeah. And do you go, well done, that was amazing?
I was on the pitch for an amazing goal when I was put on the line in the Toulon tournament when I was a referee, and I'm thinking, why did they put me on the line? And I realised how difficult it was, and it was Brazil and South Africa under 21s, and a Brazilian player to ball from about 40 yards. And there was a Brazilian player about a rizzle of paper offside, and as soon as he hit it, I put my flag up for offside, and it whizzed in and out. I went, oh, what have I done?
Did it say anything to you?
Oh, it was at that point I realised, you know, stick to reffing, done.
What's easier, reffing or assistant reffing, as they call it?
I just think for an assistant, there's two things that I just couldn't stick. That to try and give offside is so difficult. You're looking all over the place, you're looking down the line for where the ball come from. I just don't know how they do it. And the second thing, with a ref, if somebody abuses me in the corner, 10 seconds later, I can be at the other end of the field. But as a linesman, you're stuck there for 90 minutes. You just got to put up with them.
And if you make a bad call, I suppose, and you're in front of the home fans, you could be getting it for like 44
minutes. Just got to do that sidestepping, trotting up and down.
Well, I remember being linesman in my formative years at Millwall at the Old Den. And the referee said, we'll put you on the right wing in the first half and the left wing in the second half. So what you actually do, you cross the field. And half-time I'd gone in, and during the game I could hear this noise and all these people running. I thought, what are they doing? And they kept running down, they kept spitting all over the back of my shirt.
Oh my God.
And I've got in at half-time, I was covered in spit. And I said to Lyman, you've got all this to look forward to in the second half. And the ref said, well, there's no point in both of you getting dirty. He said, stop where you are.
So are all linesmen want to be referees?
No.
Do you have to say that?
I think a lot of linesmen are like coaches in football.
Yeah.
You know, there's coaches who are brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolute brilliant. But they don't want to be a manager because they don't want that, not responsibility, but they don't want to take that step. And I think there's a lot of people now that want to be linesmen. I mean, now that you can choose whether you want to be a linesman or a referee at the highest level.
Yeah.
And people say, well, I want to be a linesman. And that's their niche. They like it. I mean, I know a guy who's absolute brilliant linesman. Absolute brilliant, one of the best in the world. But I wouldn't want to run the line to him. I wouldn't want him to be a referee because he'll just get involved with the player and he'll lose his temper and then his composure's gone. Whereas on the line, he doesn't have that problem.
Yeah. Has a ref ever lost, or a linesman ever lost their temper when you've been officiating with them?
Is a smile.
A few players have lost their temper.
Not players, obviously. But when you get back into, so when you get back in at half time, are any of you ever going, oh, for that fucking strike, is that happening?
I've gone in at full time sometimes and said to linesmen, what are you doing to me? You know, I had enough problems with the players without you getting involved.
But, oh, really?
But it happens, doesn't it? Because, you know, they see things different on the line. And I had the other alternative. The worst decision I ever made in my life, I learnt so much from it, was refereeing West Brom and Villa. And Mark Delaney...
That's already a tasty...
Oh, absolutely. Full house, you know, 28,000 people there. And Mark Delaney coming into the penalty area, and luckily Dion Dublin was playing for Villa, who's a really nice guy and got me out of jail. And Mark Delaney's leaning forward and I thought, he's going to hit the ground here.
Yeah.
And it was the only time in my life that I'd ever made a decision before it happened, and I learnt so much from it. I thought, he's going to hit the ground here, and he did. And as soon as he hit the ground, I give it the biggest cut the grass you've ever seen, and goal kick.
Right.
And what I didn't allow for is Phil Gilchrist took him off at the knees. That's why he hit the ground.
God.
And Dion Dublin, God bless him, he just went, you didn't fancy that one, pal?
That sounds like something you say on Holmes Under the Hammer.
And I went, do you think it was a penalty? He went, I do actually. He said, but I know you don't. He said, so we'll leave it.
You said to him, do you think it was a penalty?
Yeah. And he went, he said, I do actually, but you don't. So we'll leave it. And I went in at half time and said to the linesman, do you think that was a penalty? He says, the most blatant penalty I've ever seen in my life. I went, well, do you not think to flag and get me out of jail? He said, you give it the biggest no in the world. He said, what could I say to convince you different?
Because you always presume that it's like the three of you are such a tight team. You
wouldn't I never imagine there's a division. Even you saying surprising me.
No, it wasn't a division. It's the fact that I was so adamant it wasn't a penalty. He's got nowhere to go.
He
could never change my mind, could he?
Oh, because you looked so insistent.
And what I'd done, I learned two things. Never make a decision before it's happened, because I thought he's going to dive.
Yeah.
And never close your options, because that boy, when I give a goal kick, he could have flagged and said penalty, and I could have got it right. But
yeah.
And finally, comedian James Acaster talks us through his relationship with football and why it ended at the turn of the millennium.
You are, excitingly, our first ever guest that doesn't really like football.
Yeah, a privilege and a pleasure.
Exciting. Obviously, never listened.
Yeah, everyone now throwing their phones on the floor who doesn't like football.
So what's your relationship with football?
I liked it as a kid.
Yeah.
Really liked it as a kid.
In the 90s, which this podcast's about.
In the 90s, which is like, where your heart still resides. And my dad was a Manchester United supporter, so I copied him and did the same. We lived in Kettering. He grew up in Aylesbury. He has gone nowhere near Manchester. He didn't go to uni there.
No. Is there a reason?
It annoyed his dad to do it. My granddad was a Newcastle United fan, having grown up there his whole life. And my dad just kind of supported Manchester United because at the time it would wind his dad up, and just did that, and that's now a genuine fan. And when I started supporting them, I think 91 was when I started following football.
Yeah.
And then, which was a very good time to start supporting Manchester United. Yeah. To just have one season where it's a bit disappointing. And then after that, it's like, I'm not a glory supporter. I was supporting them in 91. before all of this.
So is there any boyhood pictures of you in a Man United kit?
There will be some. I had the blue and white away strip. I was a much bigger... This is just... It really sums me up to a T. I liked away strips more than I liked home strips. always like the obscure stuff.
Alternative.
Yeah. Like, I never...
You could have gone further than, like, the goalie strips.
Yeah, I could have. But then you don't want to be the kid in school who always is in goal. You've just resigned yourself to the fact that you're not that good at football. The kid in school who actually bought goalie gloves, like purchased them and bought them into school, that's like, you have given up already. How have you already given up on this? Like, you still want to be involved, obviously. You know this is your ticket into it, having the goalie gloves, but...
Yeah, it's very much, Clay, you're very much saying I'm at best a character actor rather than the lead.
Yeah, I know that this will guarantee my place in the team, but no one really wants me there. But like, I had the blue and white Manchester United strip with Cole on the back. Andy Cole's my favourite player. We all went and got, I think me, my brother and sister, and got the names on the back at Old Trafford. Yeah, we had the day out and did the tour. We went around the dressing rooms.
Was it exciting?
Yeah, I remember the guy. The only thing I remember about the tour of the dressing rooms and the stadium was a story about the guy said, if anyone's got a problem on the team, Ferguson gets them up and he'll like say, okay, Giggsy's got a problem, and he'll tell the whole room the problem, and then everyone knows the problem, and then he just sits down.
No, that's not true, is it?
And that's what he told us at the time.
But you retain that knowledge, very specific.
But like, I retained that, and also like what I know looking back at myself now is that I like stories more than I like sports. So that's why I retained that story. It's just the only story you probably told on the whole tour, and I've retained that as a 32-year-old now. And like, I stopped supporting Manchester United in the year 2000. Because the season before was the best story, the best real life true story I've ever followed in my life. Like, there was so much in the narrative that was perfect. There was, whatever it had been when Hansler said you don't win anything with kids, and then you had them winning the treble with kids. It was perfect. You had, Solskjaer and Sheringham scoring in last minute. Sheringham had been taunted by everyone, scoring the goals in both finals. Cole had been seen as a waste of time for ages, and then they got York in and the two of them were suddenly unstoppable. And it was just like such a perfect narrative, and all these different players as well. It was like, I really liked the Mighty Ducks films as kids. And like, really loved those movies. Yeah. And like, I loved how every single character had their moment in the Mighty Ducks. They all had a a part to play in the films. And this season was like, you know, Karol Poborski had a little bit where he did well, and like everybody, Yap Stam, and you know, David May, who didn't really do anything for the whole season, but when they won, he was almost like the master of ceremonies with the crowd. He got up and he put his fingers to his lips, and the whole stadium went quiet. And each player took it in turns to lift the trophy and get a cheer. And May was like conducting this, and it's like, now you're doing something. You fuck all season, mate. And like, it was just like everybody had a moment where they got to shine. Yeah. And I just loved it so much. You know, obviously looking back, they were Manchester United. They weren't underdogs. And yeah, for me, it felt like, you know, it felt like that. And players
and so
who were normally on the bench, you know, huh?
And so you quit.
I quit. Well, the next season, I was like, I love football so much. I love football. I can't wait for this season. And then I remember Ferguson bought a load of players and he just benched them. And I remember watching it and being like, oh, he's just... And then realized, oh, he's just bought these players that everyone wanted so that everyone else can't have them. And now he's put him on the bench. And that's all these... Oh, this is rubbish. And I just kind of didn't like it. Also, there wasn't anything... It wasn't like, you know... What Mighty Ducks did well is that is that every time they up the stakes. So it's like, first of all, they're just a team. And then it's like they're doing the World Championship. So it's always they're out of their depth. I mean, Manchester United, it's like, you've won the treble and now you're just doing the same tournaments again. And I already know you can do it. There's no, like, you know, you haven't been entered into the World Cup as like a wild card, you know, like, you know, it's just like, you're either going to win them all again or the only way is down.
I
mention everyone.
I asked Jack D why he wasn't into football.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I was, when I was a teenager, I just thought, this is never going to end.
Yeah, that feeling. There's going to be no conclusion. But I felt like it had. So I was like, that's the perfect end to the film. Roll credits. And it's like, you can't follow it up. You can't do Terminator 2. Like,
an ex-girlfriend of mine said, I'm so angry with you with football because like Sex and the City has ended, but football will never end.
Yeah. That's what it's like. And it's like, I was just like, no.
They brought football back for some disappointing movies.
Yeah. Also, I think, obviously for ages, he was supposed to retire, Ferguson. But that year was like, he was meant to retire. And he didn't. And I remember that being like, what? You've done it now. Retire. Get a new guy in who isn't good.
Maybe Emilio Estevez.
Give Estevez a call. Get him in. Let us lose everything and then I'll be into it again. Like...
Okay, there we are with another lockdown special. As always, we end with a Des Lynam poem, Chris.
Let's have number 20.
Number 20. It is You Cannot Hope by Humbert Wolf.
Robbie Slater, see you later.
You cannot hope to bribe or twist, thank God, the British journalist. But seeing what the man will do unbribed, there's no occasion to.